This special edition of the Joe and Joe podcast was brought to you by Johnson & Johnson Innovation. We are Joe Manfredonia,
Joe Barbuto,
and Brian Greer, and together we produce an internal podcast at Johnson & Johnson, the Joe and Joe podcast, where we seek to tell the stories of regular people and the impact their ideas have on our company.
You're listening to a special edition of the Joe and Joe podcast.
J&J for short.
The podcast where, at least usually, regular people tell the stories of regular people at Johnson & Johnson. Now here are your hosts, Joe, and Brian.
On this special edition of the Joe and Joe podcast, we're joined by Barry Springer to talk about personalized medicine for the masses.
Personalized medicine has the opportunity to transform how we treat patients by making more efficacious and safer drugs.
We had a great conversation with Barry, and the things that really stuck out to us the most that we're looking forward to sharing with you are two things. One, the value and the importance of big data in helping make medicine and treatments more personalized. And the other thing we thought was really interesting was the potential impact on testing and clinical trials of medications. So being able to have participants in a trial that were the exact group that that treatments were developed for. So we were really energized by this conversation with Barry, and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode, a special edition on the Joe and Joe podcast. We are here today to talk about another trend we're calling personalized medicine for the masses. And with us, we have a very special guest. His name is Barry Springer, and he is the head of strategy and innovation and research at Janssen Biotherapeutics within Janssen R&D. And we'd like him to just introduce himself a little bit before we get into it. So, Barry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah. You know, my background in training is at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. I'm a Chicago guy originally, just outside of Chicago, so a big Cubs fan. And hey, go Cubs, right? Yeah. I lived and died with them for 108 years. I got the gray hair to prove it.
So that's funny.
But I was an undergrad at the University of Illinois in microbiology, a great university. Spent a couple years working at Abbott Labs, went back to the University of Illinois and had my graduate training in protein engineering. Whoa. Back in the heyday of using molecular biology techniques to start to tinker with proteins and used a whole variety of biophysical approaches and technologies to understand how proteins actually work at the molecular level. So,
That was awesome.
my founding.
Very cool.
Postdoc at Berkeley in chemistry, and then recruited out to DuPont, Central Research and Development. And that's where I got into drug discovery, was DuPont Merck at the time. Yeah. And did that for about 3.5 years, left there and went to a small startup biotech company called Three Dimensional Pharmaceuticals. We had a nice run, did an IPO. I was there developing a lot of technologies that were enabling for small molecule drug discovery. Wow. And we did that for almost 10 years, and then J&J acquired us, actually, in 2003.
Okay.
So I've been in various leadership positions within J&J and now Janssen R&D since that time, and so 14 years.
So you've got a title that sounds like you do a lot of different things. So what do you spend most of your time thinking about, focusing on, working on now?
Yeah, a couple of things. There's primarily it's biotherapeutics, and the bulk of that is monoclonal antibodies. We're looking for new platforms, new ways to harness the power of monoclonal antibodies as drugs and use those in particular. Of course, one of the big areas is immuno-oncology, using bispecific monoclonal antibodies to redirect cells of the immune system, T cells, to come in and kill tumor cells. So that's a big part of what we do. So I spend, I'm firmly planted in two camps. As best you can say that. One is the external innovation space. So I work very closely with my partners in JJI. So I'm a mentor for a JLabs company. I've been working very closely with the whole JLabs crowd since it started. With the innovation centers, they're our partners in terms of looking for new technology platforms as well as new molecules. And we lay out the strategy, what we're looking for in terms of new technologies, and when they find them or they come their way, then we work together to bring those in-house. The other side of the equation is developing an internal pipeline of antibodies and other biologics that support the growth of our efforts to build new drugs within J&J. So both internal and external.
That's awesome.
So you've got this lens then, both the internal and the external lens that you're talking about. So as we think about this trend of personalized medicine for the masses, how are you seeing this coming to life in both the internal and the external looks that you're taking, and how are you seeing others thinking about its importance for the future of healthcare?
And maybe even before we get there, like we could just hear you talk a little bit about, yeah, I'm going off script, Brian, watch
it.
Out.
I love it.
Maybe you could just talk a little bit about like, what is that trend mean to you and to us? And like when we say personalized medicine, can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. I'll give you my definition. And just a little more background. So in addition to being part of a small startup biotech and large pharma,
yeah.
I also have experience both in small molecule and large molecule discovery and early development, right? So I've had the pleasure of seeing a gamut of a variety of different approaches to creating new medicines. And so personalized medicine, how does that fit in? I think in my mind, that is just continuing to use what we know how to do today and taking that to the next level, right? So that the medicines we're creating are going to work better for patients. They're going to be more efficacious and they're going to be safer. And new technologies and new platforms are coming to fruition and are being validated on a rapid time scale that allow us to do that more precisely. So examples of that, for example, are being able to use human DNA, right? Sequence DNA,
right.
So that we can identify certain particular mutations in cancers, and that allows us to tailor the medicines that we are either have in-house today or create in the future to be more specific and more efficacious for those patients. And there's never, when it comes to technologies or when it comes to drugs, there's never one shoe that fits all.
Right.
And, I think personalized medicine will allow us to be better at addressing the needs of the patient. That's really the ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm. And how have you seen it? Have you seen that trend kind of changing over time? I mean, are we accelerating the rate at which we're able to do this because of technology? And how, what sorts of changes are you seeing, internal and external?
Yeah, no, I think as technologies develop, as we're beginning to see how we can harness the value of big data, genomic data, and along with patient histories, how do we make predictions as to potential disease in the future?
Sure.
How are we going to be able to take full advantage of someone who is in fulminant disease? How are we going to actually be able to treat them more appropriately? And I think it's a combination of both. I think we're going to be better at predicting down the road what kind of diseases people will get. And
right.
I think we, as part of our new initiative in World Without Disease, interception is a huge component of that. We've got to be able to detect early. And I think being able to harness big data that's coming from the massive amount of human DNA sequence information that's out there and how
sure.
that's correlated to disease is going to be paramount in terms of importance.
Man.
There's some, I got to tell you, there's some really smart people working on this, no surprise, in the Silicon Valley and other places. We had a session yesterday at here at Bio,
uh-huh.
and it was titled Harnessing Big Data to Find a Way to Cure Diseases, and how are we going to be able to capture and use that information in real time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that came out of that, we had some awesome speakers. Dr. Atul Boot from UCSF. We had Dr. Eric Green, who's the head of the Genome Center at NIH. Some real powerhouses there. And they provided a lot of insight. One of the things that is a challenge right now today is the lack of talent dedicated to this type of work.
Sure.
And because we're competing in the healthcare field with the Googles and the Amazons and the others.
Well, this is catnip for my two co-hosts who are both data scientists.
Yeah,
so their heads are about to explode.
See, they're licking
here.
Their chops. Now I know why.
Got it. Yeah, Joe's getting very excited, isn't that right, Joe?
We sure snuck into this session yesterday, it sounds like.
Oh, that's awesome.
Sounds good.
So you're talking about, when you say big data, you're not talking about, when we think big data, like at least traditionally, it's things in databases, spreadsheets, and maybe Fitbit, wellness data, about patients or medical records. You're actually talking about one step further, which is like the human body, the human genome as a data source.
Both that's actually.
Amazing.
I think the histories that are out there, and to the extent we have to be able to link those histories.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening with those individuals? Are they experiencing certain diseases? Do we know what their environmental circumstances have been? And what does that DNA look like? And it's not just, it's also epigenetic approaches, right? So, modifications of DNA that occur because of environmental changes and other changes that they've experienced
right.
or their parents have experienced.
Wow.
So, huge amount of information out there. And it was interesting, one of the topics we got into yesterday with some of the world-leading experts was, There's so much information out there. Is it too much, right? Yeah. How do you filter through that? And we're talking about trillions and trillions of pieces of data now.
Right.
I was surprised to hear that now there's not enough data. Well, more data is good data, right? So, and I think it's really about using finding ways to filter that out quickly mm-hmm. to get to what's important, and mm-hmm. then using what's important to think about therapies for patients.
Yeah, that's a theme we've heard on almost every. Yeah. Every episode so far, right? Every guest we've had on has kind of touched on that, right? It's this mm-hmm. increasing amount of information and striking a balance between getting more information so that we can make better, treatments and invent yep. new ways to provide care, but then also from a customer's perspective, allowing ways to filter all that data down
yes.
and only giving them the meaningful.
Right. So I get a recommendation, even as opposed to having to sort through all of the information myself, something else sort of helps me figure out what to do with it, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Right.
Absolutely.
Crazy.
There's another piece of that too, and it's not just therapies. It's really, can we start to encourage people to make lifestyle changes that will help in the whole mm-hmm. prevention process, right?
Yeah.
We all know that we should eat less and exercise more, right? And you guys all look pretty fit, but I could do a lot more of that. So,
no, he's sitting here with, he's got a fitness device on his arm. You can't see it, but he's got one there. He seems to be making some good progress.
Good radio joke there. Yeah. No, so, the idea of being proactive instead of reactive is something that trying to get that mind shift to change has definitely been touched upon this week too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So what about the doctor side of this then? So great to have all this data, right? Mm. It sounds like there's a lot of information available. Do you feel like doctors are ready to start utilizing this as there are therapies that can be more personalized, or as we're trying to get people to change their behavior, is the average doctor ready to start implementing this? And if not, who and what is being done to help prepare them?
Yeah. No, that's a great question, Brian. One of the issues, and there was actually a story that Rowan Chapman had provided, that if you have a chance to connect with her, she could probably fill in the gaps, because mm-hmm. I won't tell the story completely correctly. But it's really around taking that genetic information to her doc, and she's an MD, and saying, hey, what does this mean? And to her doc's credit, they say, I don't really know. And I think, we heard that a lot from yesterday from Dr. Eric Green and others that, trained MDs, especially 20 years ago, there was no topic, no discussion around how to use genomic information in mm-hmm. making decisions about how to treat their patients, mm-hmm. and now it's here, and so how do you train physicians to be able to use that? What are the sources that they need to go to understand that information? We had one of the speakers was Dr. Jennifer Levin Carter, and she's a founder and the CMO of N of One, which is mm-hmm. a company that is focused on sequencing people's DNA to understand the correlation between that and cancers and helping in diagnosis.
Wow.
It's out there.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of taking that to the next level and making it part of the normal process on how our physicians use that data and that information to mm-hmm. make decisions on treatment is still a work in progress. And I think it's going to require a lot of education. It's going to take some time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, and you may or may not know about this one, are medical schools now training, so like the next generation of doctors that's mm-hmm. coming out of school, are they preparing folks with this kind of knowledge, or is it still so cutting edge that we're not even ready to teach people how to use it yet?
Wow.
That's a good question. I'm too far removed from that to answer that question appropriately, but I certainly hope they are.
Yeah.
It's out there. This is not a big surprise, right? So hopefully it's being baked in.
Yeah.
But the tools aren't completely there yet in terms of really being able to capitalize on that. And mm-hmm. That's, one of the reasons that we had the symposium yesterday is we try to get out in front of some of the big hot topics that are coming down the pike, and this is clearly one of them, and creating that awareness, making sure that people are starting to think about this earlier rather than later.
Yeah. Yeah. It all sounds like we're putting a very positive spin on it, right? We're going to be able to deliver care in new ways and hyper-personalized, and it's going to be just for you, precision medicine. Are there challenges or drawbacks or potential pitfalls even that we may or may not even be aware of going down this road?
Guaranteed. There are always pitfalls, right?
Yeah.
I can assure you that every technology platform, and I've been doing this my entire career, there are always, it looks fantastic, it looks promising,
yeah.
But as I mentioned at the beginning, no one you know, there's no one platform, there's no one drug that's going to suit all of our needs.
Sure.
That one shoe does not fit all. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are going to be setbacks. No question about it, right? You know, I think one of the areas that we're probably going to need to pay very close attention to is the security of this information, right?
Mm.
You know, this is you guys all look like you're millennials, and you might be out there sharing all your information, but those of us with gray hair prefer to keep it hidden a little bit. But you know, it does beg the question: how much information can be shared and openly, and how do you protect that data to protect the individuals? And I think given all the security issues we've seen, in various other circumstances, we want to make sure our healthcare data is protected as well.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of actually treating patients, is there a downside to being better? You know, maybe the one initially could be cost. I don't know. We mm-hmm. haven't really sorted through that. You know, can we provide? I think that will be the challenge to those of us in the healthcare industry. Can we provide personalized medicine in a cost-effective manner?
But I
can tell you, if it works, you know, it's worth the cost, because not all of our drugs work as well as we'd like them to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, definitely, I would say after this week and hearing different speakers, I'm getting the idea that healthcare is going to look a lot different in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, how will we as patients know when the future, air quotes, is here? You know, what are we going to start to see? How do you foresee it changing or being similar in the future?
You know, I think we've seen over especially the last decade, that patients are much better informed. You know, the first thing you do when you have a symptom is Google it, right? So, you go in with, you talk to your doc, and you know, you've got your own diagnosis in hand, and then it becomes a discussion, right? So, you know, I think that will continue. I think there will be more and more access to information that people will help them own their own future health. So I think that's important. I think that's good. I think to the extent that mm-hmm. the healthcare industry can provide those tools that are more enabling, I think is fantastic. We also have to be a little bit cautious of the stories that are out there and make sure that they're not just anecdotal. So, you know, not all information that's out there and publicly available is accurate. So there mm-hmm. needs to be quality checks on that too. And that's really, I think, where, you know, the personalized physician mm-hmm. comes into play.
Yeah. How does the role of the R&D organization change alongside that? You know, as the patient experience changes and the role of the physician changes, what does an R&D group look like in the next 5 to 10 years, and what are the roles of those scientists?
Yeah, no, I think for us, it's being able to capitalize on, you know, the wealth of information that's you know, coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we want to be better at you know, the therapies that we do develop.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we would prevent and you know, prevent those from even having to need a therapy down the road.
Sure.
But I think as we begin to look at the data that's coming out, how do we tailor our molecules for those needs, right? So there are going to be certain drugs that are out there already currently available we'll mm-hmm. understand how to use better, but the future drugs will need to be tailored toward the information that's coming out. And that information is just now rolling out, and it's
right.
going to take, you know, the typical process of you know, early stages to actually having a drug that's out there and available to patients is about a 10-year process, and it's expensive.
Right.
So, you know, we're talking about a time lag here, and we're always working on finding ways to do this faster, but there's going to be a lag in terms of being able to harness this information and then be able to incorporate that into our thinking going forward. So we're constantly looking for ways to change that paradigm so that we can move things a lot more rapidly.
Yeah, that's one of the first things I thought of when I read the, you know, the primer we have here on personalized medicine. I know that it takes a lot of time today mm-hmm. to develop a new drug. But if we're talking about personalized medicine, meaning the medicine for Joe would be very different from the medicine for me,
even though they're otherwise basically the
same. Otherwise, we're basically
the
same people, same name and all that stuff. Whatever. How does that drug development process change and adapt? Because to me, it doesn't sound like it could scale. If the medication is different for every person on this planet, mm. and maybe that's an exaggeration, but still, directionally, you know, how does that process keep up? Because you can't just do 10 years for, you know, each individual, right? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, even though we talk about personalized medicine and we think about the individual, groups of people will be clustered together, right? Mutations giving rise to certain cancers, you know, we're going to be able to target those, and it'll be a certain group of people that will be able to take advantage of those new medicines. Right. So, yeah, it's not individual to the individual. It'll be clustered, yeah.
Right. Well, it's interesting, so non-scientists speaking here on this one, but I wonder, you know, as we think about testing things, you can more closely test potentially a therapy on the exact group of people that you're developing it for, right?
Absolutely.
As opposed to like, hey, let's bring a group in that's a randomized controlled trial or whatever. Yeah. Sounds like there could be an opportunity to say, hey, the people who are in this cluster, we specifically developed this for, let's try it on exactly this group and see if it works the way we believe.
That's a great point, Brian. And I should have brought that up earlier. The you know, I think one of the near-term advantages we'll see in harnessing big data and incorporating that into our thinking will be patient selection during clinical trials.
Ah.
So that we'll have a better idea how our drugs are working and in what patient population, so that that time lag of, you know, the drugs that are already in the pipeline and in clinical studies, well, we probably will be better suited for the patients once we actually get them through the approval process and out there and available. So, yeah, but as you think about the earlier stages, then, you know, it also gives us an opportunity to focus more on those areas that we now know are the key areas to make those drugs, right? Mm-hmm, and that's important.
Yeah.
So, Barry, you mentioned that some of the work that you do is related to the external environment, sort of scanning the external environment and understanding what that looks like. When you see, whether it's molecules or, you know, startups that have sprung up around these different technologies, are there different things that you sort of make you perk up your ears or that make you interested, like, oh, when I see someone or some science that has this, it makes me really listen in closely or say, I'd like to know more about this.
Mm. Right, right. Yeah, there's you know, a couple of areas. One of the areas that we're talking about right now is better use of big data. That's for sure. The other is, and it's kind of a broad topic, but I'll define it for you. It's targeted delivery. So much of what we're doing in personalized medicine requires new molecules, and those new molecules need to be targeted to the right place in the body. If they're going to be efficacious to the extent that we want them to be, we ideally will direct them right to the place they need to go. And so there's a whole host of different platform technologies that are out there to be able to do that. So one example, for example, is being able to get monoclonal antibodies into the brain in a high enough dose to actually treat diseases that we know are neurologic. That is one of the holy grails out there for biologics. Today, we don't know the rules on how to actually accomplish that. And so if we could crack that nut, that would be huge, right? It just opens up a whole new paradigm. Yeah. Another example is being able to get either an antibody or a protein molecule or even a peptide into a cell, and it addresses one of the areas that I have a lot of passion for scientifically, and that is inhibiting protein-protein interactions. So we small molecule drugs are pretty good at getting into cells, but they're not very good at inhibiting those types of interactions, and it would open up a whole new class of drug targets for us if we could figure out how to do that. So it's really in the space of what I'll call targeted delivery, and that includes even you know, being able to do deliver our drugs in local areas of the gut for IBD and things of that nature, right? So it's a brave new world in many respects. We're seeing a lot of companies work on that. Also, what's the best way to deliver a nucleic acid therapy? So, you know, we see a lot of RNAi type approaches now that are out there. You know, we can deliver, we call it naked RNA, and it works at some level. But, you know, if we could target that to the tumor directly, for example, if it's in the lung, if we could do that without an administration that goes out through the entire bloodstream, fantastic, right? Wow. Or even if you put it into the bloodstream and it hones in to the lung, it's going to be a much more efficacious drug.
Right.
So, yeah, we're all constantly looking for targeted delivery approaches.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's clear you're very passionate about all of this. And so I'm wondering, you've been doing this for a long time, and it sounds like you're enjoying it and you'd like to keep doing it. What keeps you so passionate about this space and so excited?
You know, I think it's just that I've been involved in building and inventing and buying and selling technologies my whole career for the purpose of improving healthcare. And you know, at the end of the day, it's about the patient, right? You know, and we take Dr. Paul Janssen's you know, his phrase at heart, which is the patients are waiting, right? Okay. And you know, we're all either we are patients, we're going to be patients, or we have family members that are patients, and yeah. So we're all in the same. They're all in this together, right? So that, I think that's. I work with some amazing people at Janssen and J&J that you know, are committed, really committed to helping to solve these problems, and I think that's what gets them up every day and motivated to come to work.
That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. So we know that there are a lot of voices out there that have expertise on this area. You've mentioned a few of them already that you've seen at these panels. Are there particular people that when they speak up on the topics that you focus on, you listen to the most or you're most excited to hear from, or even folks that, as you're at Bio, when you see their name on a panel, it's like, okay, I got to be at that panel. Or maybe there are other sources of information that you go to as well.
You know, we'll back up a few steps. Mm-hmm. One of the things I learned early on in my career is that some of the best ideas and the best inventions come at the interface of disciplines. Mm-hmm. The people I listen to most are people that have been trained classically in one area and have moved into another, because they take an orthogonal view and approach to the problem. So, for example, a physicist moving into biology, or okay. You know, or an engineer that's moving into biology. There's right. they bring a completely different perspective at times, and they're not afraid to ask questions and do things that someone who might be classically trained in biology would never want to do, because you'd say that's ridiculous. We're not going to do that because we know it will never work. Those are the people who make, you know, they come up with breakthrough things at times, wow. Especially in the technology space. So, yeah. You know, I think that's you know, we have a quote in actually there was a BioBuzz article that two of my colleagues, Irene Rombel and Guna Rajagopal, who actually put together and has published here at the Bio and the BioBuzz around harnessing big data. And they have a quote in there from Steve Jobs, and I can only paraphrase, but it's, you know, one of his comments was, you know, he thought that one of the greatest opportunities in the future was going to be at the interface of technology, in his mind, probably computer technology and mm-hmm. biology, mm-hmm. right? And you know, I think we're starting to see different opportunities in that space, investment starting to flow in that, to think about right. how we can bridge the power of the two to come up with better solutions for right. healthcare.
Wow. You are speaking to the choir yeah, with seriously. These two guys that are...
I don't know. I'm still like lighting up. I'm saying, what am I doing here?
Yeah, yeah, trying right, to convince you to work for and stay in healthcare and not go to Google.
That's right. Sounds like it.
That's so exciting.
It's a convincing
great.
Argument.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Well, Barry, this has been really fun. We really appreciate you coming by and spending some time with us. I've had so many things. I wish I had my notebook. I want to write all this down. But I guess the good news is it'll be on the website soon. I can re-listen.
Absolutely.
Barry, thanks so much for coming by. We hope you've had a great time here, and you hope you have a rest great at the conference.
Thanks, Joe and Brian. I appreciate it very
pleasure.
Much.
Thank you.
Right, take care.
This special edition of the Joe and Joe podcast was brought to you by Johnson & Johnson Innovation.
Special thanks to all of our guests. To Ryan Flynn, who played an instrumental role in making all of this happen, and to our executive sponsor, Mike Riley.
For more information, visit our website at jnjinnovation.com. If you have any questions about our podcast or how you can get started making a podcast at your company, email us at joeandjoepodcast@its.jnj.com.